This is Marketplace Money for the week of January 29th, 2010. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, supporting financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide since 1937. Putnam, a world of investing.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money. Here's an example of the confusion that still reigns in the housing market. On one day this week, we found out that home prices rose in November, but the next day, a different indicator said sales of new homes fell in December. Meanwhile, more and more people are just deciding to cut their losses. They are walking away from their mortgages. Can't or don't want to pay, so bye-bye. Linda Giella of Venice, California is one of them. She owns 11 investment properties.
My husband works 6 days a week, 10 hours a day, just trying to make enough money to cover all these mortgages each month, and it just doesn't seem worth it anymore. I mean, he's killing himself. And as far as I'm concerned, the contract is you pay monthly or we take back the house. So they've already gotten plenty of money, and they're getting the property back. So I don't see anything dishonorable about that whatsoever.
But is there something dishonorable or immoral about walking away? Joining us now to debate that question are Henry Blodgett, CEO of the Business Insider, and Megan McArdle, a business and economics editor at The Atlantic Magazine. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So any first reactions to Linda and her specific situation, Megan?
Well, I think there are a lot of issues implicated here. One question is, can they actually afford these mortgages? I mean, you know, there's a point at which if you're dipping into savings, you should walk away from your mortgage. But the question is, if you could afford it, should the bank be the one to eat the loss? It's not one of those things where, you know, the bank gets a choice of one of two free gifts, the payment stream or the house. The house is simply what they get to take after you have breached your contract. And the very fact that she doesn't want the houses because they're not worth what she paid for them indicates that the bank probably doesn't want them either.
Henry, what do you think?
Linda is exactly right, because what she is a real estate investor. She has gone out to a professional firm and borrowed money to buy the investments. That firm totally understands that circumstances change. And in this particular case, I would say Linda and her husband are real estate speculators. They got burned. They are going to default on their loans, which is going to create all sorts of problems for them down the road. There is no above and beyond that moral obligation or promise to pay that goes beyond what a corporation would have when it borrows money from investors.
Well, there does seem to be this growing debate recently about the morality of walking away from a home. So let's talk about this really most basic question. Is this a moral issue, Henry?
I think that there's definitely a sliding scale. Megan and I have talked about this issue before, and she has pointed to people who are just simply rampant speculators who are gambling on the bank's dime and gleefully skipping away from mortgages because the bet didn't work out and so forth. At that end of the scale, sure, somebody is abusing the system. But there is a big sliding scale, and as you get toward the middle of it, if you're so strapped by the weight of the mortgage that you can't save enough and it's really impacting your family life and so forth, that certainly you can consider walking away. And there are huge ramifications for that and reasons not to do it. But one of them is not that it's an immoral act.
Well, Megan, Henry talked about that sliding scale. Where do you put this? Is it a moral issue for you?
If you are in a place where you actually can't pay, then you should probably walk away. But I have some questions. For example, how did you get into that spot? You know, did your income take a hit, or did you have an unrealistic mortgage because you were using your house like a piggy bank? What I actually worry about is that right now, I think we're in a very good equilibrium. People try really, really hard to pay off their mortgages. That makes it relatively easy to get a mortgage, and it makes it relatively easy to have rules that make it possible to get out of your mortgage if something goes wrong. And we do that because Americans have a pretty strong internal sense of shame about not paying debts that they could pay. Now, if that equilibrium changes, what does it look like? Do we just get to walk away from our mortgages and nothing else changes? No. What happens is that then probably the rules change. They get bankruptcy made tougher. They write the contracts so that they're tougher. And the upshot of that is that the people who really need to walk away get damaged.
Well, Henry, what if we do get to the point where there isn't shame in walking away, which it kind of feels that that might be happening, that there is a sense that, well, you know what, it's just a business transaction.
Well, I think in a lot of ways it is just a business transaction. I think that's the point that I'd make. And one example that I'd bring up as to how it's so different with corporations is you just had the biggest residential complex in American history that was defaulted on. This is Stuyvesant Town in New York, where the folks who bought it, who were total professionals, said, you know what? We can't pay the loans anymore. And they walk away. And so everyone looks at that and said, well, of course, corporations do that all the time. In none of the articles that I saw written about this was the word morality ever raised. This is just simply that something corporations do. The only person that is being asked to be a moral being is the individual.
Megan, it certainly does seem like there's a bit of a double standard, isn't there?
I think that you have to look at what were the norms under which the money was lent. I would argue that the mortgage lenders lent money into a market in which people try really hard to repay their mortgages. I think banks really did have the expectation that the norm that prevailed in mortgage markets was you try hard to repay your house if you can. They did not think that what people thought they were doing was taking out an option to have the upside on the appreciation of their house and or let the bank take all of the downside.
I don't think you're changing the norm
in the mid-game.
I think that you are saddling, you're putting an unfair amount of that morality on individuals. Why doesn't the bank have a moral obligation to say, hey, this homeowner is strapped. Things haven't worked out the way they thought it would or we thought it would. Let's help keep them in their house. Because by the way, it's really going to suck for them to have to move. Why isn't the bank saying, you know what, we're just going to cut your mortgage in half? Because for us, it's just a little write-off that's going to disappear. No one will really notice. For you, it's disrupting your entire family, your school system, and so forth. This is why I just don't think it's fair to act as though the individual is the only one that has some sort of moral code here.
But Henry, what happens if more and more homeowners go this route? They walk away. I mean, what does that then say about us when a contract is no longer sacred?
The contract is absolutely sacred. And what I'm saying is that that's why the contract is there. It is to specify what happens if you do not pay. You're not ripping up the contract and saying, I refuse to honor it. Hmm. That's what it's there for. It specifies exactly what happens in this case.
And then, wait a minute. Now, if your cell phone provider just like unilaterally breached your contract, and they paid whatever $50 penalty was in the contract for that, would you be like, oh, that's okay, because, you know, they had this penalty in the contract, and, like, they can pay me the penalty? Or they can live up to the contract they signed. Would you be like, well, but it's corporate? No, you'd be furious. I would be furious. I would be on my website telling the entire world that they were a bunch of lying, cheating deadbeats.
It may be a very bad business decision for them. It's a very bad business decision for an individual who wants to borrow money in the future to walk away from debts. That's a terrible business decision. It shatters your credit rating for 7 years. And so that's what you're saying, is this corporation runs around willy-nilly, hey, we've got a little fine print line that we're going to invoke here and infuriate our customers. It's often a very bad business decision. I'm not arguing that it isn't.
I don't care if it was a bad business decision. It's wrong. It's not just a bad business decision.
If it's in the contract, it's not morally wrong. It's what a contract is for.
Megan, any chance here that maybe strategic defaults send a message to the banks?
For those people, like, yes, there's a lot of anger at the banks, but A, there's no indication that these people are going to match that to banks that have been abusive. A lot of these securities are held by like pension funds and institutions. So you're going to send a message to the Red Cross. Oops, shouldn't have invested your endowment in mortgage-backed securities or CalPERS. And I think that, you know, it's not matching the punishment to the problem. If we think that banks have been abusive, we should curb those abuses, not just go out and start like being freelance bank regulators.
Well, I'm sorry, guys. That's all the time we have. I have to walk away from this interview. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having
me. Thanks a lot.
Henry Blodgett is CEO of the Business Insider, and Megan McArdle is a business and economics editor at The Atlantic Magazine. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This week's State of the Union address could easily have been labeled the state of your wallet. The president pushed for more jobs, health care reform, a bigger child care tax credit, changes to how you pay back your student loans, and he wants employers to automatically sign up their workers for retirement plans. Commentator Amelia Tiagi wonders whether any of this will make the average American feel better about what's in their wallets.
The state of the average American wallet is bad, really bad. For millions of Americans, it feels like being a patient with double pneumonia and cancer who's in the middle of a knife fight. Now, if this were a good TV show, the handsome Dr. Obama would have discovered a miracle cure, and the ailing American middle class would be on the mend by the end of the show. But this is not television. The middle class is suffering from stagnant wages and massive uncertainty about whether they can even hold on to the jobs they have. Think of that as the double pneumonia. Then there's runaway costs for healthcare, education, and childcare. That's the cancer. Add to that spiraling personal debt, the disappearance of pensions and retirement security, and an explosion in dangerous mortgages and credit card traps. Those are the knife attacks. And this is all happening at the same time. Did Dr. Obama propose the perfect cure? Of course not. The speech missed a few biggies, most notably disability coverage, a gaping hole in the safety net that drops millions of families into bankruptcy. And a pittance more for a child care tax credit just doesn't close the gap for most middle-class families. But let's face it, the American wallet has been under attack for 3 decades, and it's still reeling from the worst recession in living memory. There is no miracle cure. We need a dozen different medicines to treat a dozen different ailments. That doesn't make for great television, or even great speeches. But if Dr. Obama really can address the problems he outlined, jobs, healthcare, education, and retirement, the middle-class wallet would certainly be a little healthier than it is today. Perhaps the most important thing President Obama did for the American wallet was to continue sounding the alarm. This patient is sick, and we need medicine now. That may sound obvious, but just a few years ago, it was common wisdom on Capitol Hill that a family with money troubles pretty much deserved what they got. The State of the Union address kept the American wallet right where it belongs, front and center on the national agenda, reminding us yet again that empty wallets are everyone's problem to fill.
Amelia Tiagi is co-author of The Two Income Trap and chief operating officer at the Business Talent Group. Low wages and no benefits make it hard for workers to get by. So should a supervisor take it into his own hands to make up the difference?
He padded paychecks. He would use overtime rates. So he quite literally was making a little market adjustment of his own because there were people who weren't getting by on what they're being paid.
The so-called moral underground. It's coming up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Green jobs have gotten an ongoing push from the Obama administration, and they came up again at this week's State of the Union address.
We should put more Americans to work building clean energy facilities and give rebates to Americans who make their homes more energy efficient, which supports clean energy jobs.
Rebates like those would be music to the ears of Marketplace sustainability reporter Sam Eaton. He recently did some simple improvements on his home to plug some energy leaks. And here's what happened.
Turns out my 1921 Los Angeles bungalow could win awards. The problem is they're not the kind you want to brag about. Here's what Trey Muffet with home weatherization company Recurve told me last spring.
Your home is performing on the lower end of this home performance index, and your air leakage is off the charts right now.
That was the verdict after Recurve performed a home energy audit. They found out that my house not only lacked insulation, it also leaked energy like a sieve. So I decided to fix it, which in the words of Recurve's retrofit manager, Robert Mitchell, comes down to this.
It's a simple step. We're plugging the holes. We're putting insulation in.
Starting with my attic, which accounted for about a third of my house's energy loss.
So what's happening here?
All right, let me get this mask off. I can talk.
So what he's doing is he's blowing the cellulose in through the 3-inch tube right now.
When we talk about those, you know, the heat we feel on those hot summer days here in LA, I mean, this is really going to make the biggest difference.
When the attic's 160 degrees in the hot summer days, it transfers through the wood framing and into the lath and plaster, and then it's cool in the afternoon, but your house is still crazy hot. It's because it's stored heat all day. This is going to stop that.
Add to that new insulation in the walls and floors, along with sealing all the cracks and leaks, and winter heat loss will also become a thing of the past. All for just under $10,000, which is actually at the high end of what it costs to weatherize a home. And even at that price, my investment will gradually pay off in energy savings and cut my carbon emissions in half. Kind of makes it a no-brainer if you've got the cash to do it. And that's a big if. Matt Golden is Recurve's founder and president.
The biggest impediment right now is consumer demand because of the fact that the economy is really in a very difficult place and homeowners don't have a lot of spare capital lying around.
But Golden says that obstacle also represents an enormous political opportunity.
The most effective tool to increase demand is a direct consumer incentive. And the most recent example of this is cash for clunkers, where we saw how quickly a consumer incentive changed behavior. And you saw people turning in their old clunkers and buying much more efficient cars.
Which explains why Congress's home weatherization proposal has been dubbed Cash for Cockers. Its real name is Homestar, and it would rebate up to 50% of the cost of weatherizing a house. Golden, who's played a central role in designing the program, says Homestar would put tens of thousands of unemployed construction workers back to work and cut U.S. carbon emissions. He says residential buildings generate nearly a quarter of the nation's carbon footprint.
Using just really simple measures that can be done quickly and using local resources, we find that we can abate an equivalent amount of carbon as taking half of all passenger cars off the road. So this is a huge opportunity.
And a relatively painless one. After just 4 days of work, my house already feels different. The cold pockets are gone. And even with the heat off, it's a consistent 68 degrees. Recurve's chief building scientist, Trey Muffet, performed the final test. He fitted an orange tarp with a large fan in the middle of it onto the front door frame.
So right now we're about ready to run the blower door, and what we're going to look at is the actual final test out number on the tightness of the home.
Muffet turns on the fan, which sucks air into the house, pressurizing it. Then he measures how fast the air leaks back out through the walls and windows.
All right, so we have 1,994 cubic feet per minute at minus 50 pascals.
I ask Muffet for a translation, and it turns out we're now blowing right past the Joneses.
Your house is probably one of the highest performing houses on the block, and probably in the neighborhood.
By insulating and sealing leaks, Recurve was able to boost the overall efficiency of my house by more than 70%. And that correlates directly with the amount of savings I'll see on my energy bill. But because I live in temperate LA, that bill was pretty low to begin with. And that means the payback time is a lot longer than a house, say, in Fargo, North Dakota. About 15 years in my case. The good news is that while I wait for those savings to turn into profits, my house is also 70% more comfortable. And that's a hard thing to put a price on. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace Money.
Are you a teacher who's bought school supplies or maybe even lunch for a needy student? Or maybe you're a home healthcare assistant who fudged a line or two on an insurance form for a patient with little money. If you've done something like that in your workplace for a struggling employee, you're part of what Lisa Dodson calls the moral underground. Dodson is a sociologist at Boston College, and she's written a new book about people who defy the policies of their employers and often the system to help low-wage workers, their families, and others who have trouble making ends meet. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Who is the moral underground? What kind of people are we talking about here?
Well, the moral underground is really a response to an economy that's just become so unfair that people, not only low-income people, but also middle-income people, face these moments when they just feel they have to make decisions, and some of those mean that you have to just break the rules. And in a sense, you're joining an underground.
Let's give folks a couple of examples of people who are in this moral underground that you describe. An early example in the book is Andrew. Tell us what he did and how that could apply to others.
Well, Andrew worked in the food industry, and he recognized that some of the people working for him work very hard, and yet they go home at the end of the week and they don't have enough money to feed their own children. He began to see his role in that, not only because he handed out a check that was so small, but he also was supposed to punish parents if they weren't fulfilling all of their obligations as workers. And he told me that he padded paychecks. He would use overtime rates. So he quite literally was making a little, I think of it as a little market adjustment of his own, because there were people who weren't getting by on what they're being paid.
All right, let's give another example. I remember B. Tell us what happened there.
Well, B was a manager in a large big box business. She had a number of people working for her for quite some time, and one was a woman named Nancy. She knew that Nancy had a daughter, Edie, who was planning to go to the prom, and she realized that Nancy was not going to be able to buy a prom dress for her daughter. She couldn't because they simply didn't have enough money in the family, based on the wages as B saw it that she was handing out to them, not wages she set, but she felt she was very much part of that chain. And so she hesitated at first, and then she told me that prom dresses often get over-ordered, some of them are returned, and she said that one managed to find its way into Nancy's hands, and Edie wore it on the prom night, and she told me that Edie knocked them dead.
Now, one thing that she says to you is, I couldn't help but feeling I was almost to blame, or partly. But as you noted, she doesn't own the store. She doesn't set the wages. She is not responsible for what's happening to this employee. But I suppose here is where you get to the argument of morality.
There are some people who look beyond the rule or the standard or the work schedule, and they consider it their responsibility to recognize the humanity in this person who isn't making enough money to get by, and see themselves as in some way implicated unless they do take a stand.
You also encountered plenty of bosses, administrators, who didn't see any of this as a necessity. If their employees were absent to take care of their kids or they didn't have transportation, that was pretty much put on the employee as having a bad work ethic. What do you think of that argument that it's personal responsibility?
Well, I found in talking to people who were working hard at low-wage jobs, personal responsibility was an issue of great concern to them. And in fact, they were doing what they were supposed to do. They're doing the jobs of the nation. And in fact, a number of the employers that I interviewed said that they really didn't see what else these working families could do. They were doing everything right. The issue really becomes not only a work ethic, but also a wage ethic. Is it an ethical structure of our wages when people are doing the jobs of the nation and raising their families, and they literally can't make ends meet every month?
Isn't there a risk, though, that they perpetuate the current system by kind of patching things up at the individual level?
I want to really emphasize that the acts that I recorded could not possibly make up for the gap between what we pay millions of our families, working families, and what they need.
Sure.
I also know that these acts in and of themselves are just not going to make the difference. They need to be part of a much larger force, much bigger change. I think one of my main motivations for writing this book was when I came upon this, and I came upon it in so many different places, I thought that it was a story that has not been told about the American character. And, you know, it really recalls our very best American history when people look at what's going on around them, and in this case, issues of economic justice, and make the decision that they are going to step up in their own way. In order to make change, there has to be much more than that, but we really need these people for that to ever happen.
Lisa Dodson is author of The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tess. I enjoyed it.
Marketplace Money is supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Here's a word you may have come across in talk of this economic downturn, man-cession. Turns out far more men than women have lost their jobs over the last couple of years. More women are bringing home the proverbial bacon, and that can change the dynamics around the house. We always get questions from you about work and family issues, including this one, and here to help answer some of them this week is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
Great to be here.
Well, our first caller of today is just exactly what that study was talking about. She is the primary breadwinner. Patricia in New York is actually thinking of doing something very traditional, though, that could greatly alter the family's finances. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. I understand that you're planning to start a family.
It's true. And after the baby is born, we're hoping to have me stay at home.
What do you do now?
Well, right now I work in advertising, and ironically, I work in a field that is primarily dominated by men.
Right.
So
yeah, it's not a whole lot different, is it, from the AMC show Mad Men?
Well,
I hope
there's been a little bit of progress.
Yeah, hopefully a little bit. You know, I feel like it's a bit of an upstream battle, uphill battle, with trying to go back to more traditional ideals. And I'm really nervous about how that's going to affect us financially, aside from just, you know, going from the obvious two incomes to one income.
So what have you done so far in trying to figure out, I guess, some of the basic math here?
Well, we're just basically slashing our income almost by two-thirds.
Wow.
But to me, that's actually the easy part of it. The harder part is how the system is kind of working against me in a lot of respects.
Sure.
As far as how I can even contribute to a retirement plan period without having a technical income.
Okay, so we're really dealing here with retirement questions and not necessarily how you're going to be able to budget once the baby comes, right?
Yeah, I feel like budgeting, you know, is something that is pretty straightforward.
Okay.
It's just all the other factors. We're also going to be moving, and I'm concerned about how me not having an income is going to affect our mortgage process.
So let's try to take a look at these two issues.
Okay.
Shall we go with retirement?
Let's go retirement first.
What are the options for someone who is not in the workforce?
Someone who's not in the workforce can take advantage of what's called a spousal IRA. In essence, it's a loophole in the law, which takes into account that there are a lot of stay-at-home moms and some stay-at-home dads who are not earning an income, but they need to save for their own retirement.
Oh, that's great.
And then the second question was about whether they'll have any issues in trying to buy a house with the fact that she is not working.
Would we necessarily pay a higher interest rate just based on the fact that there's only one income?
Banks can't require that you have two incomes.
Nope,
it's really a matter of the household and whether you can afford the mortgage.
Yeah, no, there's no bias in home ownership against the stay-at-home parent.
That completely makes sense.
I have to ask you, though, when I listen to everything that you're planning to do over the next year, there are a few major things that are life-changing events. You either lose a job, you buy a house, you have a child. Well, it sounds like you are planning to do all three.
All of them.
The job loss is voluntary.
Yeah, it's going to be very difficult, I know. But for ourselves, I think this is all worth that challenge that we're going to be facing.
All right. Well, it sounds like you're on your way. Good
yes.
luck.
Thank you so much for your help.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And let's go next to Joyce in Billings, Montana. She is looking at how she can save for her kids' college expenses. Hi, Joyce.
Good morning.
How old are your kids?
They are 13 and 15.
Well, what is your plan currently? Do you have 529s or anything like that?
We do not.
You do not.
We have told our children from day one that they need to be excellent students because they're going to have to be writing their own college scholarships.
Uh-huh.
However, we are in a position now to inherit a goodly sum of money.
Ah.
And so we have the decision to invest in their college education or pay off our own mortgage debt.
You know, sometimes I do question, you know, when we decided that parents are on the hook for kids' college funding.
Oh, that's another whole conspiracy about that. That's the educational loan complex. Now, what's the mortgage loan situation?
We have a first, and unfortunately, we were suckers and got a home equity line second at about $50,000, which has a variable interest rate, which is extremely low right now.
Okay.
And our first is at a fixed at 5.25%.
Joyce has given a consistent message to her kids. However, what about putting aside some of the money for college, and then you go after that home equity loan. Yeah. And if there's enough in the inheritance to get rid of the home equity loan, you know, frankly, I'd get rid of it.
Joyce, is this inheritance something where you could make a serious dent in that second mortgage and perhaps even have some left over?
We can totally pay off that second mortgage.
You can. Right?
That's certainly what my husband wants to do.
It is a wonderful moment when you own that home free and clear.
Absolutely.
All right. And you're getting older, so retirement gets closer. And owning your own home as you're entering in retirement and your kids are leaving, that's really a safe way to enter your
right.
older years, your retirement years.
Let me put something else on the table. Joyce, have you thought about doing something fun with some of this money?
Actually, we're going to treat ourselves to Hawaii next month.
All right. Yeah. There you go.
Yep. That's wonderful.
Good.
That's great.
Yeah. I mean, we're all for being practical on this show, but sometimes,
right.
you know.
Up to a point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So Chris and I would both like to join you in Hawaii.
Okay.
I do hope that you have a wonderful time in Hawaii, and it sounds like you've got a few first steps here. At the very least, get that second mortgage paid off.
Yep.
Right. We'll do that.
Okay. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you very much.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And you can also send us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be taking more of your questions later in the show, including a lesson in comparative personal finance, to obtain a European credit card or not to obtain a European credit card. How do we decide what's worth our hard-earned cash and how much of it? A $29 movie ticket may seem extreme, but
if they feel like, well, you know, all I did was see a movie for $29, it's not worth it. However, if it gets classified as a different experience, who knows if $29 is too much? That might be the bargain of the century.
We'll explore our brains on celluloid up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Oscar nominations will be announced on Tuesday. Now, why are we even mentioning that news here? Have you seen the price of a movie ticket? Now, I'm not one to grouse about how I used to go to the talkies for, what, $5-6 when I was a kid. I've even paid as much as $15 for one of those theaters where you can reserve your seat, and that's pretty much my limit. So when I saw a new theater open in my neighborhood where the ticket price was $29, I wondered, what could they possibly be thinking?
I have two for Sherlock Holmes at 7 o'clock. Do you have a credit card I can start your food and beverage tab with?
Yes, thank you.
Gold Class Cinemas opened last month and got instant buzz all around town. Even here in Hollywood, $29 sounds like a lot to pay for a movie in the middle of a recession, right?
Yeah, I think it's expensive. It sounded like a lot to me.
That's my friend Laura, and we were chatting just around the corner from the Gold Class lobby. She is an avowed on-the-couch-at-home-with-hubby movie watcher, and she was almost indignant when I asked her if she'd be interested in buying a $29 ticket.
No.
Same with my other friend Gloria.
No, never.
Now, Gloria does like to go to the movies, but at a tiny neighborhood theater, not the local multiplex.
The bargain matinee that charges $2 for the first show and $3 at all other times.
This is a woman, however, who will spend good money, and I mean good money, to see the opera. It's different, she insisted. It's an experience that she has valued at sometimes hundreds of dollars for 2 to 3 hours of entertainment, kind of like a movie. I asked Gloria and Laura and a few other 40 and 50-something friends to form an entirely unscientific focus group to evaluate $29 movies. They agreed once I said we'd pick up the tab.
Hi there.
Hi there. Tess Vigeland for 8.
For Up in the Air at 7:45. So there are your tickets.
Thank you.
You're just going to head down the two sets of escalators, and a host will greet you at the bottom.
Okay, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Now, we've heard from the you've got to be kidding crowd. Not everyone thought it was entirely nuts.
I think it's kind of a one-time experience.
That is my husband, Dan. And take note, he will not be the last person to use that word, experience.
But I think to do it more than maybe once or twice a year is probably too much for most people.
Karen?
I normally would pay about $9.50 for a matinee. Whether this experience is
$20 better than I would normally pay is what I'm looking forward to finding out.
Karen noted she could rent an awful lot of movies from Netflix for $29. But two in the crowd didn't hesitate.
All right, Kevin?
I would spend $29 for a movie ticket. Just has to be a really great show.
Robert?
You know, I'm a huge movie fan, so I absolutely would pay this amount of money. What messes up a movie for us is the crowd. People are talking, a two-year-old's hit me in the back of the head with popcorn. You know, not good for me.
So what is it that makes some of us react immediately with a, no way, and others with a, sure, why not?
People associate movie theaters with something that should cost about 10 bucks.
We interrupt this story to bring you the expert. Frank Murtha studies behavioral finance at the consulting firm MarketPsych.
If you make it about the experience, it's a lot harder to quantify. It's a unique experience. You've never done anything like that before. Just the pure novelty of it makes the experience something different.
And perhaps worth more of your money. He likens this to people who save their last pennies to buy scalped Super Bowl tickets. We all have different limits on what's crazy. And we're often willing to shell out for something that's out of the ordinary. So let's get to the pitch for the $29 movie ticket.
It's really a better value, and it's a better night out.
That, of course, is the marketing chief for the theater chain, Mark Mulcahy. He says they expected 7,000 customers in their first month. Instead, they got 14,000. And what brought them? Well, here's a sampling of what you'll hear when you first sink into the enormous recliners inside the theater doors.
Quickly, what we have in the outside armrests, you open those up. You can store bags, coats, anything you like in there. Okay, and then the green button on your tables, if you push that button, it's actually your call button. It will turn red. If you
need, and on top of reserved seating, no advertising, in-theater dining and cocktails, and of course the show. Well, Cahey says a little back-of-the-napkin math will show that $29 just might be cheap.
If you were to go to dinner and a movie, you were to go to a restaurant of similar quality and go to a multiplex, we're going to get you out of here for the same amount of money. We're also going to save you time. If you've got kids at home and you have a sitter, you just saved on 2 hours of babysitting costs. We're also going to save you on gas and parking because it's all going to happen right here.
And so with menus in hand, our focus group went up in the air.
To know me is to fly with me. This is where I live.
Me, George Clooney, a pillow, blankets. Okay, fast forward 109 minutes, and our expert Frank Murtha predicted the following.
If they feel like, well, all I did was see a movie for $29, it's not worth it. However, if it gets classified as a different experience, who knows if $29 is too much? That might be the bargain of the century.
So I did a survey as the lights came up.
Any change of heart about paying $29 for this experience? Gloria?
No, not for me. It was a very enjoyable experience, but $29 is a lot to pay for admission alone.
I think the experience takes a little getting used to.
But what about the price point? Does this change your mind at all?
I would come more than once or twice a year.
You would?
Me yeah. Too.
Karen, what changed your mind?
I was envisioning seeing something like a Harry Potter movie, which would normally the audience would be filled with kids, and coming here and not having to deal with one single child because they're not going to pay the $29.
So Kevin, did it confirm for you?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. For sure. Again, not for every single movie that I would see, but I would definitely pay again.
All right. And Laura, you were a major doubter before arriving.
And I moved from no way to I would for a special occasion.
Ah.
It wouldn't be frequent, but I would. No kids, good food, although I couldn't always see what I was eating. But
So I'm curious what do you think that tells you about how you make evaluations of what's worth spending your money on? Because you said no off the bat.
I did. It was a Pavlovian reaction, I have to admit. And I thought about your question earlier, and I think I do that. I look at things that seem expensive to me and automatically think I won't like it. And so a little taste of something, a little sample here and there, definitely changes my opinion. It opens my mind.
My mind going in, 15 bucks was about right. As I sat there, I added another 5 for no cell phone signal, 5 for cocktails delivered to my seat, and sure, let's say another 4 for no little legs kicking me through the movie. Yeah, that's what I'll be thinking next time I pay $29 to see a movie. And we're going to ask this question, what were you thinking every couple of weeks? What makes us do what we do with our money? So send us your stories at marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to strengthen America by empowering more young people to achieve educational success beyond high school. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We're back with more of your questions, and I'm here with Chris Farrell to take a look at a couple of issues about the market. And Chris, I know a lot of us are always saying you got to focus on the long term. If folks focus on the short term, peaks and valleys, they're just going to go crazy, right?
That's right. Absolutely.
Well, Jason in Anchorage, Alaska, is looking to the future, but he still can't quite shake his anxiety. Jason, what's the issue?
I'm kind of concerned about the baby boomer generation and their retirement and passing. As they take that money out, what's going to happen potentially to stocks and mutual funds over the next 20, 30 years?
Oh, my goodness, Jason. Can I ask how old you are?
26.
You're 26, and you're worrying about
I love
what
this
the
man.
Boomers are going to do to you.
I love this man. It's a great question.
I like the long term. I listen to you guys, so I'm taking it to heart.
All right, Chris. Well, you are a boomer yourself.
I am.
So
I am
can we blame
member.
You if the market tanks in the next 20 years?
You
maybe
might...
not tank.
You might be able to.
Oh.
Now. As you can imagine, this is a question that fascinates economists. There have been a number of studies looking into this issue, and you sort of boil them down, and what Jason has isolated, looking at the stock market, you can project about the stock market declining about a third. That's if the baby boomers are selling to the younger generation here in the United States. But what if the baby boomers are selling into a global economy? The stock market is global. It's not domestic. So you're selling into a global economy. The real issue is, what is the health of that global economy? How vibrant are the economies? That's what's really going to matter.
Cool.
Jason, are your folks boomers?
My mom is.
So are we going to be blaming them too?
No, they don't have any money in anywhere.
Oh, boy. Well, that's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, so I have to worry about myself and them.
Wow.
But I'm thinking about it now, which is kind of strange. It's not something they necessarily passed on to me, I guess.
Well, good for you. You'll break that cycle.
Yes.
All right. Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So the boomers are out, but the rest of the world is in. And Chris, our next caller is a world traveler herself. Renee is in Auburn, Alabama, but she jets over to Europe a lot for work. Renee, I am so envious. What do you do?
I'm a professor of comparative healthcare policy here at Auburn University.
Oh, so you're what? You're going over to Europe, checking out their healthcare systems and trying to see how that might help us?
Yes, indeed. Europe and other places as well.
Well, what do you think of the healthcare debate right now?
I think Winston Churchill had a great adage that you can always trust Americans to do the right thing once they've exhausted all of their possibilities. So I'm hopeful.
I like that.
I like that a lot. Tess, I think you should sort of type that out and
put
it up in your office. Yes.
I really like that.
I got so many questions to ask, but I have a feeling we need to go on to the...
I think we do need to go on, actually. And Renee, I understand you were not calling about healthcare, but some other disparity between the U.S. and Europe.
Yes. One of my colleagues recently returned from a trip overseas. And her and I got to talking about our experiences, and we both have noticed that increasingly when we travel and we use our credit cards to pay for things, they have to go back in the back and retrieve what looks to us like this antiquated machine to process the credit card transaction. And while they're going back to getting this machine, they're mumbling to themselves, especially if they don't think you speak the language, something along the lines of, I wish these Americans would get on board with the rest of the globalized world.
This sounds like the metric system, Chris.
Well, it's a good analogy. It definitely is a good analogy. Yes, our credit card system is based on the magnetic stripe. Now, Europe has a very different system. So there's a chip inside the credit card. And then you put in your PIN number, and the transaction doesn't happen until you put in that PIN number. And Europe moved toward this system, I believe it was like around 2004. There was a lot of issues with fraud.
So this is a better system against fraud?
It is a very good system against fraud.
So why don't we have this?
There are many reasons, Tess, many, many reasons. One of which is that the European Union can impose standards in ways that I don't think we can here. Here in the U.S., we're kind of going to end up being a holdout. What you hear a lot of when it comes to the U.S., it's going to be too expensive. So until they're forced to, they don't want to shift to this different system.
So, Renee, I don't know about you, but I guess my question would be, aren't we supposed to have the best banking system in the world, the most modern banking system in the world?
I think after the last couple of years, very few people were actually going to be saying that.
Well, that's true. Chris, anything that Renee can do? I mean, the first thing that pops into my head is you get a credit card from a European bank, but I don't know. Can we do that?
So there's just a couple of things. The one thing that I would check is some of the major global banks. They have a customer base, which is people who travel overseas a lot. And I would approach them and see what they have, what kind of offerings they have. By and large, though, I think eventually we're going to shift to the chip and PIN.
All right. So, Renee, not a lot of easy solutions for you, but that's the story.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Question.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Happy travels.
Thanks.
Bye. Whether you are in the Alps or Alabama, we want to hear your questions on personal finance. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or send us an email. You can do that with the Getting Personal link at our website. It's marketplace.org. Our own Chris Farrell with us for a few of your calls. Thanks so much. Great to see you again.
Thanks, but I have to tell you, boy, Hawaii, the Alps, wow. Starting to think about travel.
Well, happy trails to you then, too. And remember to always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. At the end of last week's show, we took a look at the do's and don'ts of asking for wedding gifts, specifically the cash kind. We asked Emily Yaffe to give us her perspective. She's also known as Dear Prudence at Slate.com. And here's what she said about diving for dollars as you say I do.
You just can't say, hey, don't go shopping for me. Here's my PIN number. Make a deposit.
And Prudy also frowned on listing gift registries on the wedding invitation. Well, knock me over with a Wedgwood china set. You also had something to say about this. Here's a sampling.
I think asking for donations to charity is a great idea, but suggesting help with the wedding expenses or gifts to pay for a house is unforgivably rude.
I think our modern era is in need of rethinking gift-giving etiquette in an age in which we are overwhelmed with stuff. Please, Prudence, don't add to our problems. Help us find a way to politely help gift givers give something that will be appreciated and not something that will be a burden.
I received a wedding invitation and thought, thank heavens they included a registry list. We are old but out-of-town friends, and spreading the word through family and friends would not have worked in this case. And as it turned out, we got them something she will appreciate every time she cooks.
I'm sorry, but I'm nearly 50, and I would much rather have an invitation that lists where the couple is registered and purchase them a gift from that registry. And if I don't make it to that store, I'll write them a check. It's easy, and you don't give someone something they do not want.
Those were our listeners, Norris Wooten, Carla Willis, Casey Cassidy, and Joanne Arknall. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, millions of people in this country feel like they're in dead-end jobs. But what if they could do something different through their employer?
In this country, we're used to thinking that everybody has a chance to make it. But we aren't always used to thinking that everybody deserves a second chance to make it as well.
Some companies are offering low-wage workers a new opportunity through education.
She's gone through this program and succeeded, and she's doing the right kind of job for her. She's in the right field.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and Jolie Myers. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, working to solve America's retirement savings challenge through innovation, service, and performance. Putnam, a world of investing.
American Public Media.